Welcome to Zero Downtime, the new podcast brought to you by DCD's editorial team in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical infrastructure provider.
Vertiv has kept the world's leading businesses connected for more than 50 years. We build, deliver, and support critical infrastructure that's available, sustainable, and future-ready. Visit us at Vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Zero Downtime. I'm DCD's editor-in-chief, Sebastian Moss. And today I'm going to fail to match the energy of Bill Clayman, former Switch EVP and current Neuro board member. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Seb. You just be the yin to my yang, man. You don't have to match this energy. We're just gonna make sure we flow this thing. You know, it's when we're in the ocean, it's not just one giant wave, right? It's ebbs and flows. You know, and we're just gonna have a really wonderful chat here. And I'm gonna try and contain the espresso shot that I took 30 minutes before this call.
Well, I've not ever seen you ebb, so we'll see. Maybe I'll bring you down, but let's go back in time to start. You know, I do want to talk about your current life or your conference jet setting. You know, a lot of people who listen to this who are part of the conference scene will know that you are a fixture. I would like to talk about that, but let's go way back, how you got into this industry. You started at Herjavec Group, is that correct?
That's a really great question. You know what, Seb, and everybody listening, we're going to go on a little bit of a more of a journey here. It's kind of a special one. Mm. I actually got started in tech. The nexus behind all of this was much earlier than this. So even though it says Bill Clayman, you know, my real name is Vitaly, Vitaly Yurevich. I was born in Kyiv, Ukraine. And just to kind of keep it a little bit short, my brother, he's 12 years older than I am. His name's Alex. And he would compete in telegraph competitions. You know, I'm like, no joke, like full-blown right. telegraph competitions. And when I was little, I loved seeing him do that. And he would occasionally let me sit on his lap. He would, you know, put on these big cans on my head. And he would give me like the little telegraph switch right in front. And, you know, he taught me Morse code, nothing crazy, like a little bit of the alphabet, some numbers and just stuff like that. And I would communicate using this telegraph switch. And what an extraordinary feeling it was for like a 6-7 year old to be able to just communicate. You know, obviously we had phones. I mean, it was Soviet Ukraine, but we did have phones. But to be able to communicate in this method, this different kind of method, beeps and boops, right, with somebody that's across the country, you know, in Siberia or some of these other places. And that was fascinating to me and everybody. It was something that I really took to heart and never, ever let it go. Fast forward, knowing that I had this fascination for technology, I think this was an industry that I fell in love with very quickly. When we came to the United States, you know, I pretty much, even in high school, I took AP Comp Sci. Yeah. I was like the webmaster for our athletics department back in the day. I was doing HTML coding in Notepad. So like, I'm an OG HTML guy. And I remember very specifically going into college. Now, what was really fascinating is, and Seb, I'll tell you, this is a funny part. Mm. And every single time I go to a data center conference, and everybody listening, I'm sure you're gonna attest to this. I ask the question: how many of the people in this room are natively part of this industry, right? And like, nobody usually raises their hands as a former musician, former pediatrician, former gym teacher, former music teacher, former physical therapist. Now they're in tech and data centers. I'm one of the few people that actually raises their hand. So I went to school for network engineering. Network engineering, communications management, and then I got an MBA concentrating in marketing, another master's in information security. But like you mentioned, I actually started off pretty much right out of college when I got my network engineering degree at a little company. It was called Performance Network Solutions, and ultimately it was bought by CyberClix, which was ultimately bought by the Herjavec Group. And if you're not familiar, that's the guy from Shark Tank, Robert Herjavec. Interesting guy. You learn a lot from having that kind of a leader. And I had a chance to really dip my feet into, you know, back then it was kind of still cloud. I would say this was in like the 2005, 2006 era before like the namesake really came out. I was doing virtualization, Microsoft systems, Citrix, VMware, working with traditional converged, hyperconverged architecture for what later became UCS, NetApp, Pure Systems, Pure Storage. all of those kinds of environments that would be supporting small and medium enterprises. And that was kind of the start. And I know I got my hands dirty popping the hood on servers with cobwebs on them and supporting people with, you know, how does this CD-ROM drive work? I'm sorry, that's not a cup holder. You put CDs in there. And, you know, just kind of learning the ways as a young admin and just troubleshooting some issues and then just growing from there. But yeah, just started out small company that eventually got grown, that eventually grew and got acquired. And then went to an end user shop, spent a year in DevOps, spent about just shy of a decade at the United States' largest platinum partner in Citrix. And then I found my way into Switch. And now I work with generative AI. That's like a long-winded answer. My gosh.
Well, you skipped past a few of the, you know, I wanted to say after Hirschvec, you got into steel tube pipe guys, right? Worldwide fittings. But on the IT side, you weren't there.
Worldwide fittings, and I'm going to share this podcast. Sean McCarthy, if you're listening to this, shout out to you. He's one of the best, you know, bosses that I ever had. I was like 24, 25 years old, and he gave me the keys to the kingdom. Right? He's like, Bill, you know, we're challenged. We're spending way too much in IT services. They didn't really have an inside guy. I had been supporting them from the outside for a while as a consultant. Then I came in as their full-time, you know, IT director. And I got a chance to build a budget, full IT environment. You know, I was supporting 6 locations in the United States, working with 2 in the UK and 1 in China. I'm sorry, 1 in China, 2 in the UK, 1 in the UK, 2 in China back in the day. Now the organization has grown, but oh my gosh, Sebastian, I learned so much in terms of understanding how the business worked and how to support IT. Now, the one thing that I'll tell you and everybody listening, and this is coming from Sean, he made me do this. Before I could really truly support them, he made me go out into the warehouse and he taught me how to pick orders. I used, I learned how to use an AS400 system. My God, I'm like a millennial and I knew how to use like basic COBOL and RPG to input codes in there. But I got a forklift driver's license. Oh my God. Yeah. Cause I went on these things and I would pick an order. I would make sure it was right. But that gave me an absolutely intimate understanding of how my users were using our systems and what we could do to improve it. And so literally at least once a month, probably multiple times a month, I'd go out with the crew and support them. It wasn't anything massive. It was not major, you know, but it was a sizable organization that leveraged things like, you know, cloud and VMware and certainly Citrix, because there were times when Chicago decided to throw up 2 meters of snow, you know, like 3, 4, 5, 6 feet of snow and they couldn't come in. People couldn't come in. So they would use these virtualization tools like Citrix to log in and be able to process work. But that was an extraordinary time. I absolutely enjoyed that. But to be honest, it was manufacturing. And I spent about 3.5 years there. And so I got bored because I did everything I personally needed to do and got them in a really great state. And that's when I became a senior virtualization architect for a company called MTM Technologies, which was later acquired by ATSG. I was a part of that and exited after the acquisition happened. And that was a really extraordinary experience as well, because that was just the time we started to see the shift in BYOB, bring your own devices, you know, bring your own license, BYOL, whatever acronym you want to use. And it was interesting because that's when we saw this shift in how you, Seb, and I, and everybody in the world start to communicate with all of these myriad of devices. You know, all of a sudden you're pulling up a virtual Windows desktop on an iPhone. What? But sometimes that was the case in what people needed. So that was an extraordinary time to learn about virtualization, end user compute, and sort of all the systems that are supporting that, including pizza box servers that you put in a rack, and now high density compute and things like UCS, and how those impact organizations, both from a cost as well as an efficiency and density perspective. So that was also a really, really fun experience.
And that was quite a lengthy run. Right. It was like seven years or so that you were there.
I was there for full time, about 6.5, 7 years. And I grew in the organization, virtualization architect, director, VP, and then CTO for about a year and a half. And then I stayed on the board. It was a paid advisory role. It was a lot of fun. And a lot of what I did there was continue to support the Citrix relationships and the technical relationships, and just make sure that the organization continues to thrive and grow. until it was ultimately acquired. And again, I'm so blessed. You know, I'm still young in this industry, and I had this opportunity to be put into leadership roles to help these organizations continue to be, you know, competitive in a crazy evolving market.
And so you worked with data centers, but you weren't at a data center company until you got a switch, right? And that's, for want of a better word, quite the switch. You know, how did you adapt? Is it different being on the other side of the table?
You know, this is where I say I was natively a part of this. So my degree in network engineering, I'll be clear. I went to a technical school. I went to DeVry. I knew what I wanted to do. And so in 2.5 years, I had a bachelor's degree. I mean, I was 21 years old, like entering the job market while many of my friends were still in their junior year of college. And back at DeVry, in my networking courses, they were run in parallel to things like CCNA, so Cisco certification courses, and Microsoft certification. And in our labs, and everybody listening, we would sit down at these stations, right? But right behind us, like a giant row, I still remember this vividly, it was a data center. There's no other way. There's no sugarcoating it. They were multiple 42-unit racks. There was Cisco, NetApp, HP gear in there, all sorts of different kinds of things. And we were tasked with pulling stuff out, configuring it, doing rack management, putting the stuff in. So while in some ways I wasn't swimming in the data center pool, like, you know, we'll talk about here in a second, I was really very intimately introduced to it. Literally right off the bat when I was 18, 19 years old, entering college and getting those networking degrees, because we would go into those labs often through the course of my education. We were in there frequently doing different kinds of projects, programs, working in groups, configuring different kinds of things. So I would say that you're right. When the time came for me to switch, no pun intended, I like what you did there. I went to switch. Now, That happened very natively. Now, I guess the one thing that we sort of skipped out here was when I was at Worldwide Fittings, I got a little email from this little company called TechTarget. And they're like, Bill, we would like for you to comment on this data center blog. Because at the time, over at Worldwide Fittings, I mean, I was working in a small data center, you know, and I had built up a lot of it, right? Everything from containment to cooling to efficiency, everything was done, you know, by us. And they asked me, Bill, do you want to comment on this blog? And this is going to sound so funny. I'm like, sure thing. And so I wrote him basically a blog. I didn't just write him a comment. I wrote him like a blog. And the editors come back to me. They're like, Bill, this is really good. Do you want to write for us? And I'm like, I don't understand. They're like, we'll pay you money to put stuff on our website. I'm like, no way. And they said, Bill, come on, seriously. And so, yes, that started in 2010, 2011. That's when my writing journalism career, what do you want to call it, began. And since then, I've written thousands of articles, dozens of technical white papers. I have an Amazon best-selling book called Greener Data that I helped co-author. Greener Data version 2 is coming out really soon. I wrote the foreword for the latest ASHRAE book on DSIM and DSIM management. You can find that out there. That was a really fun thing to do. But that all sort of started my journey in sort of being an evangelist and an expert in the data center industry, writing about new technologies, visiting folks. So when Switch approached me, I was a year into, hang on a second, everybody, a year into an extraordinary role at a company called EPAM Systems. Now, if you're in the data center industry and you haven't heard of those guys, it's probably because they're in DevOps. It was a completely different field. And it was a risk. I absolutely enjoyed it. It was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made to leave that company, because here I am learning the inner workings of cloud, refactoring, relicensing, migrations of massive applications. But what I learned, where I was a really strong fit, was I was the guy that was helping them understand the bridge between physical systems and the cloud. How do we connect? How do we create multi-cloud ecosystems? And that's kind of where I learned that cloud is not the default. It's not. Many, many, many enterprise organizations want that hybrid multi-cloud approach. And I was the person helping design UCS systems and so on. And so Switch comes about and says, Bill, we'd like for you to come over to us, and we want you to be, you know, one of our leading technologists. We want you to be you know, one of our evangelists, and we want your help to, you know, spread the awesomeness of Switch in the industry. And when I joined the company, they were about $4.5 billion publicly traded. And my last day was in January of this year, totally amicable. Still good friends. I actually just visited them out, in Vegas this week. I forgot, it was Oracle Cloud World. I was out there this week with them. You know, we ended up selling the company officially in December to IFM and Digital Bridge for $11 billion, took the company private. And that's when, you know, I made the exit. And what an extraordinary experience, what an extraordinary company. And my gosh, Seb, and everybody listening, I got a chance to work for the Ferraris of the data center industry, if I'm gonna really call it that. It was an extraordinary experience of being able to see the really, really cool aspect of our industry, where we are so much more than big buildings and blinking lights. These infrastructure places are just so nifty.
And very red as well.
So very red. Very red, very black. It's kind of interesting to mention, half of my wardrobe is still all Switch colors. And if you're listening to this, I will happily continue to wear my Switch swag, because it looks lovely. I don't mind, but there's a lot of red and black in my wardrobe.
Yeah, it's I've been to a few Switch data centers and they're a lot of red. Luckily I'm not a bull, so I'm fine in them. But
bull in a data center. Oh, bull.
Well, we have a kind of ongoing series at DCD, which is animals and data centers. So we've had a deer broke into a data center. Obviously, the crocodiles outside Google's data center. The sharks that bite submarine cables. There were cows that caused outages by sitting on cables. Beavers causing outages all the time.
The data centers that have windows in them and they leave those open. We had a bird successfully get in, and I had a squirrel get into a server that had a CD-ROM drive missing, and it died in there, and it was horrible.
Oof.
Yeah.
Well, there's a story I heard on the grapevine, not enough where I can write a story on it, of an eel that worked its way up from the Thames and into a chiller at London data center. So, you know, my email is public. If you were involved and want to tell me more, you can get in contact. Your anonymity is guaranteed. I mean I want to jump back to, I don't know if I can call them, speaking of animals, the WWF, Worldwide Fittings, how working with data centers there helped, to your point that thankfully not everything has moved to the cloud, but if more and more does move to the cloud, there are going to be fewer opportunities for the Bill Clemens of today who are working at enterprises around data centers to get into the sector via that route.
I feel, and I'm sure everybody can understand this as well and attest to it. I mean, we see pendulum swings all the time. And there was a serious time when the pendulum swung heavily towards the cloud. You know, my team literally just sent me a note, and I'm going to pull it up. I know we're live here. And the note was that, hang on, it just literally came in. Here we go. Our cloud exit has already yielded a $1 million savings in just 1 year. And this is an organization that's doing quite a bit around things like core applications and DevOps.
Is that 37 Signals?
What was that?
37 Signals, is that the people, or is that you guys were the ones that left?
No, that was a different. This was an article that I read. Yeah, and there was others that we've seen the use case where there's a big benefit. But I think the point is not to bash the cloud. I think the really good thing about our industry right now is that we're finally at a point where there's an understanding of what needs to be living in the cloud, what needs to be living on prem. It's no longer just like a default putting in Amazon. And so many conversations that we're having right now begin with repatriation in mind, moving those workloads back on-prem. And I've actually been, let's say, scolded for using that word repatriation, because it's a terse term, whatever you want, cloud balancing and whatnot. In the AFCOM State of the Data Center report, 83% of respondents this year came back and stated that they saw a repatriation of workloads from the cloud to on-prem. And this is the first year that we asked them, well, cool, but what are you seeing repatriated? And I was shocked. DevOps, ERP systems, virtualization, virtual desktops, you know, things that, again, in the past were by default living in the cloud. I promise I'm going to get to the question that you asked, you know, what does this mean for these organizations? The reality is, from what I've seen, is that the data center, if anything, is experiencing a resurgence right now, a pretty sizable resurgence, and not just in the hyperscaler space, in the secondary and tertiary market. I mean, look at what's happening with folks like, you know, DC Blocks and even like, you know, one of our partners at Nero, Scott Data Center, who's in Omaha, Nebraska, who's doing extraordinary things, you know, in a place that I personally feel is going to have an AI boom. And we can talk about that. So Worldwide Fitting specifically, they have an IBM AS/400 environment. It's very difficult to put that box in the cloud. It is. It's very difficult to do that, right? The migration cost, the support, all of that. Even today, it's a little bit challenging. So there's always going to be use cases for keeping infrastructure on-prem. Cloud has a cost to it. And I think what organizations are understanding now is what does it cost me to deploy this widget in the cloud versus what does it cost me to continue to run it on-prem and the control that I have? And I really don't feel like we're going to see any sort of deprecating effect on data centers, certainly because of cloud, and certainly not the small ones either. I'm actually kind of excited about what we're seeing in this industry as far as the resurgence and the growth in the data center sector. I mean, it's wild, Seb, right? Everybody listening, I mean, look just it's silly. And the one thing that I'll tell you right now is that Nova, Northern Virginia, while let's call it the current mecca of data centers, that's not going to be the case anymore. I'm going to be presenting as a keynote speaker at a W Media event in New Zealand coming up October 30th through the 3rd of November. So I'm going to be out there, long flight. But what's fascinating to me is that market is going to experience a big surge probably in data centers, because what people are realizing now is that, for example, these large language models, they don't need to be close to the data sources. They're not latency sensitive. They need to be in facilities that are high density, access to capacity, access to power, and are relatively inexpensive, and that they're green. So these emerging markets in Australia, New Zealand, South America, India, Pakistan, all over are going to be able to capitalize on this valuable workload by being able to support it and not have to be Northern Virginia. Just as an example, nothing bad about Nova, but just saying.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you can get power in Nova, then nothing bad. If you can't, you might have a few bad things to say, but that's a different discussion. On AI, I do want to get to that later, but I might as well ask now. I think the big unknown is how much will be training, how much will be inference, because to your point, training latency is less important. You still want to be close to the data you're using to train, but you don't need to be fast at responding to a user. Whereas if we're not doing as much training in the future, if it kind of slows down after the current hype wave, inference is where the majority of the workload is going to be. Their latency matters. And then it goes back to Nova and FlapD and all of those places.
So that's a really good question. And I think for everybody listening, let's pause there for a second. So we just talked about two different things, right? We have the large language model training and we have inference training. So large language model training is where you take all of that big data, right? That's where we have those big multi-billion trillion parameter models, and where you train this data to be able to consciously answer a question about the data that you're training it on, right? Whereas inference training are the little bits, the little edits that, you know, you make when a user or a piece of data interacts with a large language model. Those are the little edits that you make. That's why it needs to be closer. Now, the difference is that inference training can be done on a pizza box server, on a CPU. You don't need GPUs for that. That's why it's a lot easier to do that stuff closer to the data. But for that big training, it's a little bit different. The reason I feel that large language model training is not going away anywhere is because of the GPT evolution that we've been experiencing, right? So for the first time ever, so GPT-3 was 175 billion parameters. GPT-4 was 1.8 billion parameters. And we only found that out because some of the data leaked. That's nearly 1,000 times bigger than GPT-3. The reason that it's impactful and the reason we're going to continue to see more and more model training is because we're entering the world of what's called multimodal data. And that's what GPT-4 is, where unlike its predecessors, GPT-4 allows you to take in both text and images to produce text as an output. So this gives you a massive advantage over previous models, which could only handle tasks. Could only handle text. I promise I can talk. But by combining the types of data, these various types of data, you all of a sudden have this really powerful architecture that can perform really diverse and challenging requests. And that's not going to go away whatsoever, because we at Neuro, that's where I'm at now, and I know we're going to talk about it, the kinds of use cases that we're seeing, Seb, everybody, I don't know how to say this in the span of our podcast, but we're talking to industries and people who would have never even said the acronym AI, who would have never even looked at that. You know, the kind of semantic search and large language model training that we're doing for industries is extraordinary. And I don't mean that sort of lightly, somebody dabbing their foot in there, but the way that we interact with data has fundamentally changed. It's done. That's it, right? And the days of when, you know, Sebastian has a question and he's going to go on his favorite search engine, ask Jeeves, Yahoo, if he's feeling feisty, maybe he'll even go on Google. He'll ask a question and you get the blue link, right? The same blue link. 20 years of that, we've been doing it. Now, Seb asks a question and he gets a conscious answer. If you think that it's not going anywhere, right now, Bing and Google are already integrating generative AI answers to people's questions, and then the blue links, they're below. Holy cow, they've moved down in rank. They're no longer as important, right? All of a sudden, you see the generative response. So I strongly feel that there's going to be a place for data centers and facilities that are doing traditional compute for inference training, but also those much bigger instances for large language model training.
Although I will say, please do still click on the blue links, because that brings you to us and that makes us happy and means that
very
I can...
true. Yeah. My blogs are tied to those blue links. Thank you, Seb. Yes.
So, you know, especially while we still haven't quite worked out hallucinations and, you know, these models aren't always the best at accuracy, you know, we're free. You can visit us. But I wanted to ask a bunch of switch questions. I might come back to them, but we've started talking about AI. Let's talk neuro. How did you get into that job?
It's fascinating. The journey is fascinating. So after leaving Switch, I promised myself I would take like a month off, which turned into less than a week, if you remember that well. So Neuro was born in 2019. It was actually built out of necessity and frustration by very smart AI and ML engineers. And the challenge was that there was really no one single platform that was capable of supporting all of the AI and ML requirements for an organization. So they built this platform. Now, what was fascinating about this and what they realized is that they didn't just build a platform. They built an entire interoperability platform that could be white labeled. And this thing, this platform that we have, the closest thing I can compare it to, with Parity at least, that we feel that we're better, is like AWS SageMaker. It includes development, code management, training, model management, permission, resource management, but then we realize it also is a multi-tenant ecosystem. So a facility, a data center, Sebastian data centers, for example, could deploy a bunch of GPUs, put Neuro at the very, very top, and all of a sudden it's Sebastian data centers AI, right? So when we were deployed in 2019, we immediately won a couple of Gartner awards for like cool tech, cool AI tech. And at the time, they made a decision about which market they were going to go into. Now, a little bit of clarity. Neuro is a Ukrainian-born company. It was born in Kyiv, Ukraine. And at the time, they started being a white label company for an organization. It was a data center and telecom that was the size of AT&T and Verizon combined. Huh. Right, it was pretty big. And Neuro was the platform, the AI platform for many things. The challenge was they were Russian. And the war broke out. And obviously, our entire business was built on that customer base. So very challenging decision to pull the plug, and quite literally a decision to shutter the business almost entirely, because there's just no way we're going to continue. At that moment, a couple of other Ukrainians that I've known, Yura and Vova, and a couple of others who I've known for like 20 years plus, bought the company, brought the IP and everything, code infrastructure, everything in the United States, Delaware-based company now. And they're like, we need somebody in the data center industry to help us rebuild this business here in the United States. And so they gave me a call. And so now what we've been doing is this, to be quite blunt, we democratize the capability for organizations to become an AI company quite literally overnight. And my experience at Switch taught me something very, very special. We're going to talk about that the data center industry is so good at selling space, capacity, and power. But once you start talking about these like additional services, their eyes glaze over. They don't know how to approach this. So we created a model. It is a complete, actually, if you look at it, we're the only multi-tenant model available right now, multi-tenant platform, I should say, available for the data center industry. So again, Sebastian, all you would do is put in capacity GPUs. We would sit on top. And all of a sudden, you're competing with Amazon and some of the other big ones. Great for the retail facilities because they know that their customers, they want this access. They don't really necessarily want to be in the cloud because right. Amazon and other places, they charge quite a bit. You have to reserve instances of like 4 or 8 or more GPUs where our model democratizes it. And you can do 1 GPU, 2 with the right licensing model. We can even fraction out a GPU. Literally take one and carve it into little pieces if you need it. And we're almost always less expensive. So all of a sudden, Neuro became this white label platform for data centers in the United States and abroad as well to literally right off the bat begin to compete in the AI market where they can continue to be very good at what they do. Peter Gross said this, and I will repeat it all the time, right? The data center industry loves innovation as long as it's 10 years old. We don't have 10 years. We don't have 10 months even, right? We're already behind what the hyperscalers are doing in terms of AI, generative AI, and gobbling up those customers. What we're seeing is a market that doesn't necessarily want to be in the cloud. They don't want to be overcharged. They want data locality. They want data proximity. They don't want their data to be used to train some other foundational model. And so they're going to their colocation partners and they're saying, can you help us? And the colocation partners are either saying no, or they'll say, well, we have GPUs, but that's it. To the customer, while that's attractive, they're like, you don't have a platform. That means we have to build everything, that we have to start from scratch. So fine, I'll just do this in Amazon. But we come in and we say, just it, that's it. Connector, move your workloads, move your training data, and right off the bat, you are fully in control of your ecosystem. And that's been meaningful. And I think since then, we have several partners. We're actively deployed in a couple of data centers already. And we're just continuing to grow, and we're not short of use cases.
So if you have a business model that's kind of BYO GPU, while we're in a GPU shortage, though, right? Is that a limiting factor?
So, all right. I'm doing this because you're my friend, and you're going to get a little bit of an exclusive here at the 31 minute mark. Oh, I hope I don't get in trouble for this. Don't edit this out because I am going to say it. We have one of our partners right now, and they're going to be deploying H100s, DGX H100 units. Yeah. Now, their investment is sizable, but we're in the 8 to 12 week range,
right?
Because of the partnerships that we have. Not really more than that. So, you know, if someone's listening to this and you're like, hang on a second, Bill, what are you drinking on a Friday? Actually, I promise it's just water. There you go. Maybe improve it to you.
That could be straight vodka. I don't know.
Oh my, way too much straight vodka. I promise it's water. You know, in that sense, what's been fascinating to us is, yes, there's a GPU shortage, but now, oh my God. Okay. We don't just work with NVIDIA. So the cool aspect about our software is Sebastian logs into our portal that's in, you know, one of your data centers. And inside of the portal, you'll see different instances, right? Big, you know, medium, you know, small instances, and then you'll have different pricing on it as well. What we've been doing is that you can do Intel GPUs, you could do AMD GPUs, or you could do NVIDIA. So Sebastian, hypothetically, you have 3 different data centers, NVIDIA, Intel, AMD, all of that points up into Neuro, and we abstract all of that hardware. Now, AMD a little bit more expensive, let's say, because maybe a little more powerful, but let's say you don't need those. You could do with AMD. Already, we are doing some really fun testing with AMD. And I'm telling you, what they're going to be coming out with, if you think that the only horse in this race is going to be NVIDIA, eek, time out, pump those brakes. Because believe me, Intel and AMD want a piece of this pie. And right now, we are, again, the only company that's capable of abstracting those resources and pointing it to this interoperability layer. So to your point, while there might be challenges of getting Intel GPUs, I'm sorry, NVIDIA GPUs, thank you. Yeah. It's not as bad with the development that we're seeing with AMD and Intel. And those technologies are inspiring. They're extraordinary. Some of the things that we've seen that are going to be coming out of AMD very, very soon, they're going to shake things up. And what we have is access to that. And we're seeing how it performs. And we democratize it. Like I said, we abstract that layer and are able to position it. So to your earlier point, yes, there are some constraints, but it's not going to be forever.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big stories of what next year, right? Is this year was the year of NVIDIA. They captured this AI wave almost completely. But based on everyone else trying to catch up and because of the shortages, Cerebras has obviously signed a $900 million contract. AMD's MI300 is a pretty damn good chip. Intel's been slowly getting their shit together.
They'll do it.
You know, they sometimes require being beaten for a few years to wake up, and that's kind of what's happened with CPUs. They move slowly. They're a big ship that takes a while to turn, but when they do, there's a lot of momentum.
We've had very early productive conversations with them, but again, I'm excited. But what you're talking about is a long term, a very long AI tail, let's call it, where we're going to continue to see these kinds of use cases, and Intel and AMD are going to be able to get a good chunk of this market for a lot of different kinds of use cases. I'm excited to see what's coming out.
Yeah, no, I think we've got. Just a plug on my end, Next Magazine, we've got the AMD CTO. He talks a bit about what they do to try and get rid of this stranglehold, as he calls it. I think we've got some Intel people that they're a little harder to get to say anything concrete.
I think they're just waiting for the concrete to settle.
Yeah, I think so. But it's very exciting times. And I think having a platform that can kind of allow for a bit more openness on the hardware front so you can swap in different hardwares would be lovely. So that is exciting.
That's a pretty special part. And again, it gives the power back to the user. And again, it reduces cost. It increases the amount of visibility they have into the environment. They know what they're doing, how much they're reserving, what they're actually using it for. So while the cloud is a powerful tool, you're going to see, again, for the time being, we're the only white label platform out there. I don't think it's going to last forever. But that gives us this extraordinary ability to go to data center partners and allow them to compete in this industry and help their customers out.
Let's talk about that from a visibility perspective of, on the one hand, we're in an AI boom. You're an AI company. Great. On the other hand, we're in an AI boom. Every company is now saying, hey, we're an AI company. Every company's got some AI thing to shout about. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have very large budgets. How do you even get through all that noise and get in front of anyone?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't want to sound pretentious at all. I mean, I've been in this industry for a while, and I guess, a part of it is me going out to people. But when it comes to AI, you're right. There's a lot of cars on the road,
right?
But there's not a lot of garages that can build those cars. And we're the garage. Right. And so we are giving the capability for people to build the car that they want and slap, the name of whatever they want on the car and then drive it off and be amazing with it. So, while we're not building the fastest car in the world, we are the garage that helps people build the fastest car in the world. And the special part about this is that there's no name above our garage, which means that anybody could use this. And again, that's that white label aspect of it. I mean, you can come out and build the fastest car in the world with us, and it becomes yours, always yours, right? It becomes the data centers or the client's technology. Our line of business is twofold. One is to go into the retail colocation data center space and allow them to compete in this area. And then the other is the enterprise. When we have companies come to us and they have a very specific statement, Bill, here's our data. Here's a problem that we need to solve. Could you please do it for us? And that's when our consulting arm takes over at Neuro. We build a large language model for them. We create the customer environment, and then we deploy it on our partner facilities, right? So for us, the way we're making our own swimming lane is by being a very unique organization. While there are some folks out there, a lot of AI companies, and everyone's saying that they're an AI company now, we have a pretty specific vision of how we're impacting this market and specifically what we're doing. We're not everywhere. We're not out here flailing our arms. We are the easy button for infrastructure for data centers to become an AI ready organization. 7 days. That's how quickly we're able to deploy it. As soon as you give us GPU architecture, within 7 days, we're up and running. And just to give you a specific example, one of our partners is a repurposed crypto, right? They had A100s and now they're grade four. For AI training. And the first week we put Neuro on top, that first week we put a production workload on top. And right now we are asking our partner for an additional 5 A100 nodes because we filled up capacity faster than our partner could even promote it to their internal customers.
Oh, that's very, I think there's a different story to be told one day about Ethereum miners, how they lucked out. The Bitcoin miners all got ASICs. Bitcoin crashes, they can't do anything with the ASICs, they have to steamroll them. Ethereum miners got GPUs. And you know, you look at CoreWeave, they were able to pivot very successfully.
See, CoreWeave is a great example, and I love that people bring it up, but CoreWeave is Microsoft. It's all OpenAI. I mean, it's all reserved by Microsoft. So even though they have that capacity, CoreWeave is forever monogamously married to Microsoft. You know, that's not, I shouldn't bring up relationships. I'm not like promoting, you know, promiscuity here. But you know, for us, it's a little bit different where we have a facility or infrastructure that, you know, we work with full of GPUs. Let's take that same CoreWeave example. We have a partner. I'm just hypothetically saying this, that comes out, spends $2 billion, fills their entire facility with GPUs and puts us on top. They are an immediate competitor to OpenAI and AWS SageMaker and probably half the cost.
Right. So the other end of the angle, maybe this is the person that builds the garage, to your analogy, is the whether the facilities can handle these GPUs, right? Ooh. And so dragging this way back to Switch, your Switch days, Switch was very bullish on the potential of air cooling. Yeah, I remember what we talked about, 60 kilowatts, I think it was, cooling with 55. Do you think this is finally the tipping point? Is your view everything's liquid, or where are you on that?
I'm really grateful that you're asking this question. And I know we're a few minutes into this, and everybody listening, get off your Amazon shopping list. This is an important chat. So we at Neuro, we actually have to pause sometimes our marketing activity because we have more demand than we have capacity for from our partners. And the challenge here is that while we are actively working, I would say right now in parallel with probably 3 or 4 other data center partners, the challenge is that they came to us and everything is amazing. We want to do this. We want to invest the capital. We want to buy the GPUs. What's your average rack density? 8.5 kW a rack. And I'm like a single A100 DGX 6U node is about between, I would say, 6 and 8 kW a rack. A DGX H100 is about 10, 10.5 kW a rack. Just one, right? What are you supposed to do if your average rack density is, you're going to ruin this really expensive piece of equipment. So that's been a big challenge for us, is you have an industry that wants to do this, but all of a sudden they're being asked to go from 8, 10, 12 kW to, holy cow, Sebastian, everybody listening, 40, 50, 60, 80, 100 kW a rack? Like, what are your options here? So one of our partners, and I'm going to give you a shout out, Scott Data Center. We just had a call with them. They're phenomenally future thinking. They're out in Nebraska, in Omaha. And these folks are looking, and I don't want to give too much away, but they're looking at, for example, rear door heat exchangers and some customized rack architecture that's going to get them into that 60, 80, 100 kW per rack. But they understand the investment. They understand the extraordinary need from their own customers to do this. Now, is it all liquid? Yes and no. Immersion liquid cooling is awesome. I think it's great. Single phase is a wonderful architecture. I'm a big fan of it. But what I've seen be quite successful as well, where you don't have to rip the Band-Aid off, is a rear door heat exchanger with good containment, with excellent airflow metrics, with, for example, sensors going on the back of the rack so that you immediately know, you know, where your hot spots are, where your cold spots. And even in that sense, you can pretty quickly rank up in terms of how much kW per rack you can support. But the reality becomes this. For a retail colocation data center, their customers are doing model training. They're doing AI. They would rather be in that facility. So they're going to go there. They're going to ask, are you capable of doing this? And the response is either, no, I can't, or yes, I can. But eventually the customer is going to be overpaying on the big hyperscalers. So they're going to look for colocation providers that do have that level of capacity. Long-winded answer. This is a moment of reckoning for a lot of people. This is an existential moment where you have to ask yourself, Let's think of it this way, right? It's the 1920s and the 1930s, right? And all of these data centers are gas stations. They're all gas stations, right? They're really good at filling up gas and changing your oil. And in comes this energetic chipmunk and says, you should start selling lottery tickets, Gatorade and Pepsi and Snickers bars, because you're going to make more money on that than you are, you know, with oil and gas. And fast forward to all these gas stations that have those concession stands, and they are actually making more money on those things than they are in gas and oil. But what I'm trying to say is I want the data centers to continue to be good at what they're doing. I want to sell the popcorn. You sell the movie ticket at the movie theater, and my tub of popcorn is going to cost more than your movie ticket, and you're going to all make money off of this. That's the reality. Oil and gas isn't going anywhere, maybe eventually with electricity, but oil and gas isn't going anywhere right now. And you can still go to a movie theater without buying a tub of popcorn. But that's the business model that you have to ask yourself. Like, am I going to continue to be this legacy type of model, or am I actually going to be able to embrace a very growing and hungry for capacity market.
So I want to talk about legacy. I know we're already longer than most DCD podcasts, but no. Bill is a talker, dear listener. I'm sorry. I want to talk about legacy, which is, you know, when you kind of popped up on the data center scene, you were the data center millennial, right? Which I think speaks to the age issues in the industry. I think a decade or so late, you're still one of the youngest faces in the sector. That feels like quite a problem.
We talked about this earlier, and this just happened recently at a Data Cloud event that I attended. And the question was asked, and I was in the audience, fortunately, how many people are natively a part of this industry? The room was full, Sebastian, and me and a gentleman sitting right next to me were the only ones that raised their hands. In the course of my career, I've seen the data center industry grow from, you know, nondescript buildings that no one is allowed to know about. We shouldn't know what's inside of them. It's secret, secret, secret. To right now, where we do have an existential challenge of a giant swath of brilliant people that were perfect for our industry that have no idea what they're doing. That have no idea what they could do in our industry. I'm sorry. And so with folks like Infrastructure Masons, where I'm on the I'm the education chairperson, or where I'm on the board for Nomad Futurist, for example, as well, we're going to high schools and colleges and universities and talking to electrical, mechanical, computer, civil engineers, and showcasing to them, like, all of your expertise is directly translatable into the data center industry. I'm not going to lie to you. When we do the AFCOM State of the Data Center report, that average age is up there. And, you know, I am still sometimes often one of the youngest executives or leaders in this industry. I am seeing a change. I am seeing more young people get involved through these organizations like Nomad Futurists and iMasons, where we're just being, it's a slow churn. It is a slow churn. And finally, like, for example, one of my students that I worked with, her name is Jai Huntley. She now works with Phil Marangella over at EdgeConnex. And she was an electrical engineer, is an electrical engineer. And I had her up on the keynote stage a couple of years ago and I asked her a very pointed question. Jai, would you be in this industry if not for what we're doing? She's like, Bill, I had no idea. I had no idea that I can apply my electrical engineering skill set to power capacity planning for massively amazing infrastructure. I mean, this person is now in tech. It's a long-winded way of me answering your question. It's still a problem. It's still a challenge. And we're growing as a community that again, you know, people thought we were just these big buildings and blinking lights, but we're so much more than that. And I know we were poking fun slightly at, you know, Switch and the redness of it, but if you ever get a chance to tour one of those facilities, they are very cool and they look amazing and they're really well designed. Security is paramount, but if you do go inside and check out those facilities, you know, and not just that, not just them, right? You know, I've been to supercomputing facilities. Look what Nautilus Data Technologies do. They have a floating data center, Seb. They have literally a 7.5 megawatt floating barge, and it is the coolest thing in the entire freaking world. And so you have to get people excited. It's still a problem. I think it's alleviating slightly. But that's an effort for everybody on this wonderful podcast. You gotta be a champion of that too.
Yeah, I think it's in Germany, they're about to do an open day where they let everyone into their data centers. I think that's something that the industry as a whole just needs to be more open. talk to people, tell people what you do. Even more so now that data centers are becoming headline issues of people wondering, why is this thing taking up all the power? Well, maybe start talking to them and they might understand.
Oh my gosh. We have a DCD Virginia event coming up, and I don't want to give it away, but we might have, I wrote an article recently, Get Off My Lawn, You Crazy Data Center. It was on data center knowledge. And it was because the first time in my life, in my career, I experienced protesters at a data center event. It was at a DICE event, and I befriended one of them, and I had a chance to speak to a couple of them. So I'm hoping to get her and one more person on a panel at DCD Virginia. So like you said, Sab, we can actually hear from them. What are your concerns? And the fascinating thing is that they don't like that term NIMBY, not in my backyard. Yeah. You know what they say? They're like, we don't mind you being in our backyard. We don't want to go back to the Stone Age and use like wood tools and carving, you know, stuff in a stone. We understand this is a necessity, but the challenge is how you're getting there and how local governments are responding to our concerns. And they were legit. They were valid concerns, man.
So I also wanted to talk about, you know, you mentioned DCD's Virginia, as well as some other events. You do a lot of events. You travel a lot. Every time I load up my LinkedIn, you're somewhere else.
That's true.
As someone that travels a fair bit, not as much, I am increasingly getting jet lagged and tired and worn out, and my inbox is escaping me because I can't look at it while I'm traveling.
Yeah.
It's a toll. It's an emotional, it's a physical, it's an energy toll. It's a family and friends toll. How do you deal with that?
I think if you look in a textbook and try and look up a definition of extrovert, it's going to be my face. And I do mean that genuinely. So if it's expertise, and obviously it's planning ahead. You know, I travel with little bits of home with me. Like I have my own Fire Stick, you know, that I have with me. That's got all my favorite stuff. I'll go to a hotel room, plug that in, and be able to just like start streaming all my favorite things. You know, I bring a little sound machine so I can sleep better. You know, there's little things that you can do to make your life a little bit better, but you do have to balance it out. So as much as people see me traveling, what feels like is nonstop, some of these trips are only like 1 or 2 days, right? My longer trips are like what I was at Oracle CloudWorld right now, which was, you know, Sunday through Thursday. But like, if you're listening to this, you have to know your social battery, right? So I feed off of people, but then like at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, I don't always remember that my battery is like on zero. So like you crash and you have to be able to decompress a little bit, which means sometimes I might not go out for an extra drink or an extra dinner. Like I'll get all of my important stuff and socializing done in the middle of the day. A lot of it's pacing yourself. A lot of it's knowing your own limits. But most importantly, it's just being true and open to yourself. Nothing's more important than your health or your family. So if you feel like that's starting to become jeopardized, reevaluate, you know, reassess. But for me personally, I love those conferences and events. I mean, they're so much fun, and I always get a chance to learn and speak to people. So for me, somebody who's an extrovert, I mean, you all give me energy.
Yeah. No, I can never match your energy. It's always like a bunny jumping around everywhere.
Perpetual energizer.
I'm going to ask a question that is going to bring the energy down. It's a depressing one, but I feel it should be raised. As you know, you talked about your Ukrainian roots, Neuro's Ukrainian roots. You've spoken about that and about the difficulty of having family members there. Mm-hmm. For our audience, you know, is there a charity or a cause that you think they should support? And equally, you know, I want to take some time to highlight all the people that are keeping Ukraine online and all the work they're doing as well.
Thank you for that. It means a lot. So we do have family and friends. My brother's currently in Ukraine as of this recording, and he's actually going to be working with a couple of military units. I can't specifically say what he's going to be doing, but he's staying relatively safe. Let me answer your question immediately. I don't have a specific organization that I work with, only because my brother and I, we do fundraisers. And, you know, by the way, you know, bill.clayman@gmail.com is my PayPal account. We can share that out. And we do collections. We go to these, our friends, and we ask them, what do you need? Whether it's drone parts, Kevlar vest, a scope for a rifle, or medical gear. One of our friends, my brother's high school buddy, he's a medic, former oncology surgeon turned medic, and he had his van blown up by a mortar round. And so he didn't have a van. So we did a raise, raised, I think, like $4,000 or $5,000 and bought him a van where he literally could just rip the seats out, put injured in there, and get off the battlefield. So to that extent, you're welcome to look me up, anybody listening. And every single dollar, anything that is given to me, is there's no service fee. There's nothing. It goes straight to military units and medic units that desperately need that support. You know, our family and our friends and folks that are working there, it's a level of resilience because it's an existential fight for them. And I understand the complexities of politics, and I understand, you know, all the things that people might be reading about who's supporting it, who's you know, potentially, stepping back a little bit. The penultimate thing is it's pretty black and white here in terms of, you know, who the aggressor is and who just wants to be a sovereign state. So for us, the most important thing, it's like one of those few times where people say thoughts and prayers and you roll your eyes. I'm not going to roll my eyes. That means a lot. Like, that means you're thinking about the country and my friends and family and what they're doing, what they're sacrificing to just be free, to just live. But as far as supporting them, a great way to continue to do that is just find me online, send me a direct note, look for my fundraisers on LinkedIn and Facebook. And just know that every penny, including, like, I'll even add to that, get sent over to people who desperately need it.
And I think to your point on thoughts and prayers, just don't forget it's happening. It's easy with all the terrible things happening in the world when something drags out to just let it slowly disappear in your mind as you focus on the things of the problems of today. Just remember that it hasn't stopped, you know?
No, but it will when Ukraine wins.
Yeah. I was trying to find a way to have a happy ending after bringing the tone down when they went. I really appreciate the time. I know I promised a half an hour interview. It's coming up on an hour. Thank you so much. Do you have any closing thoughts or comments?
I do have a couple of things. We're going to be experiencing some extraordinary things moving forward with healthcare, legal, and everything else, especially around things like generative AI. My one thing I want to tell everybody is never lose your childhood sense of wonder, because when you stop dreaming, you stop innovating. And on that note, if you're in the data center industry and you do want to do this, just remember, vision without execution is hallucination. So if you're going to do it. Because right now I feel like we're already losing a lot of the hyperscalers out there, and it's a market that desperately wants to consume these advanced technologies. And I feel like the data center industry is absolutely poised to make all of that happen.
It's an exciting future ahead, and I can't wait to be writing and talking about it. And I'm sure we'll catch up again soon, you know, in Virginia 100%. And elsewhere. Thank you again for coming on. I had a great time.
My pleasure.
Thanks everybody for listening.
Yeah. Thanks everybody.
Sustainability is no longer a nice to have. It's a priority. Vertiv Power, cooling and IT management solutions for critical infrastructure, are designed to reduce the use of energy, water, and space. From innovative liquid cooling to dynamic grid services, we work hand in hand with customers to enable them to meet their data center sustainability goals. Visit us at vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Thanks for listening to the Zero Downtime podcast, brought to you in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical digital infrastructure provider. Don't forget to like this podcast and subscribe to our channel. We'll see you again next time.